This podcast is brought to you in part by Contact My Politician, a free, fast way to find your local and national politicians and to keep them accountable. Click on their banner at our website, michaelmedved.com. And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great day when the transition has actually begun. And one could say, finally, today is 3 weeks after the election. And President Trump has not conceded yet, nor should he, say a lot of his diehard supporters. And in fact, there is a new poll that just arrived from Politico.com. It's a morning consult Politico poll of who Republicans would prefer as their nominee in 2024. And the winner, well, the winner we will get to is not particularly a surprise. What is a surprise was a decision by a Holocaust museum to mount an exhibit honoring somebody who was not a victim of the Holocaust, George Floyd. How has that gone over around the world? Because there is now international reaction to it. We will cover that for you. President-elect Joe Biden today introduced his six most important foreign policy advisors and officials, people like the National Security Advisor, the new advisor named Jake Sullivan, and the new Secretary of State. This all pending approval by the Senate, confirmation by the Senate. But there is one of these six foreign policy appointments that is controversial. I mean, profoundly controversial. In fact, it's been drawing some pretty snarky responses, and it seems to me very appropriately snarky responses. Who is it? Which one? We will get to that on the Michael Medved Show as well. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. There is a great deal of conversation about the fact that the General Services Administration relented on the idea of allowing the transition to proceed. This means there is now the availability of top secret briefings for the incoming Biden team. There are some funds that are made available for them to make the transition go forward. But President Trump, who was very genial and very winning and very pleasant in the turkey pardoning ritual, where he went through, I believe it was corn. There were corn and cob were the two turkeys, and it was corn who got to be pardoned by the president of the United States. But he enjoys this, clearly, and he seemed to be in good spirits. He has made it very clear he does not concede the election, and there are folks who still believe that he has a path to victory. Jenna Ellis, who was one of his top campaign lawyers, the one who wasn't thrown under the bus by Rudy Giuliani and the others, that one would be Sidney Powell. But Jenna Ellis was on MSNBC, and she had this to say in clip two about what is happening with the campaign and the counting and the certifications. Michigan certified yesterday, Pennsylvania counties certified, and the state on the way. The election seems to be moving ahead along with the transition, but Jenna Ellis had this to say.
The point of all this.
Well, the point of this, of course, is to get to fair and accurate results because the election was stolen and President Trump won by a landslide. And how you're mischaracterizing this, I think that your viewers need to understand the truth of this.
Okay. Again, the allegation that President Trump won by a landslide, I think fair-minded people, including some dedicated conservative Republicans, recognize that the proof for President Trump winning by a landslide simply doesn't exist. As a matter of fact, Joe Biden won by the biggest measure of the only candidate who won by a bigger measure was Barack Obama when he ran the first time in 2008. But other than that, you'd have to go all the way back to 1988, to the last century, to the last millennium, to find a candidate who won by a bigger margin in terms of the popular vote than Joe Biden did. The 4% that he has as a margin is significant. And again, Obama won by more in 2008. And of course, George Herbert Walker Bush won by more in 1988. But other than that, this is a convincing victory. And somebody who comments on that is the Michigan representative, Representative Fred Upton. He spoke on the election results and had this to say. This is clip 3A.
As you look at it on the surface, I mean, this is not a, you know, 4 years ago, the president won Michigan by about 10,700 votes. No one challenged that. It was all said and done. You know, we've had a pretty good vote system here for a lot of years. They keep the ballots. They're accurately tabulated. I know a number of my local board of canvassers. I know all my county clerks. There's never been any excuse of a fraudulent election that I can recall. Now all 83 counties have done that, and it's time to move forward so that the process can be official.
That's Representative Fred Upton of Michigan. He then followed up on that with clip 3B.
You know, the voters spoke, and here again in Michigan, it's not a razor-thin margin. It's 154,000 votes. You got to let those votes stand. People know the process. They knew our absentee. I voted absentee. So did my wife. So did my parents. So did my brother and his wife. The process has been in place for a long time. It works. And there's no issues of fraud anywhere. So 154,000 votes. I mean, we had a county commission race. My own county commission race was a dead even tie. They ended having a draw to see who won because it was exactly the same. 154,000 votes is plenty to overcome. I mean, it's over.
And by the way, the story of the transition and the transition beginning today, it's covered in the Wall Street Journal, I think in a fair and responsible way. General Services Administration Chief Emily Murphy, they write, who had been formally holding up the transition for more than 2 weeks, citing uncertainty in the results, said yesterday her agency would provide Mr. Biden federal resources meant to ensure a smooth transfer of power. Mr. Trump said he has instructed aides to cooperate with the transition approved by the GSA, though he pledged to continue legal efforts to overturn this election result. I believe we will prevail, Mr. Trump tweeted. Nevertheless, in the best interest of the country, I am recommending that Emily and her team do what needs to be done with regard to initial protocols and have told my team to do the same. Well, good for him. The decision by the GSA came as Michigan certified the results of its election, which Mr. Biden won, and authorities in Pennsylvania moved closer to making his victory there official. No evidence of significant voter fraud, reports the Wall Street Journal, has been produced, and Republican allies in Congress had signaled growing impatience with Mr. Trump and his team, though party leaders haven't publicly pushed him to concede. Some advisors have urged him to talk up another presidential run in 2024, even if he doesn't plan to follow through. The president has also privately indicated he wants to keep up the appearance of a fight until the bitter end, telling one advisor, everybody loves a fighter. There's a new poll that indicates maybe, just maybe, President Trump is right. There is also a column by a liberal academic who says that the left makes a big mistake to continue talking about how our whole political system is unfair, that we need massive systemic change. He says our political system is unfair. Liberals need to just deal with it. How? We'll talk to that liberal viewpoint, which is realistic, actually, coming up on The MedVed Show. On the Michael Medved show, there is a great deal of attention, of course, right now, as there should be, on the upcoming battle in Georgia. We're talking, of course, about the races, and there are two of them. They're taking place simultaneously, so it's really functioning as one race, to make sure that Republicans maintain control of the United States Senate. Until these new seats are filled, the Republicans have that because you still have the outgoing Senate. They get a new Congress, a new Senate on January 3rd. Then on January 5th, they have this race in Georgia. All the Republicans need to do is win one of the two. I think it's very important, actually, they win both of them. And they will maintain control of the United States Senate. There's a poll that came out earlier this week that showed that by a substantial margin, some 20 points, Americans in general, and this is not just in Georgia, but Americans in general, Americans in general do want to see Republican control continuing in the U.S. Senate because we believe in divided government. The idea of handing everything over to the Democratic Party, the House under Nancy Pelosi, putting the Senate under Chuck Schumer, and with Joe Biden as president of the United States, with all of that, that's not a popular prospect for the American people. And people showed all across the country that they were capable of splitting their ballots. The spending in the Georgia Senate runoff is extraordinary. They are saying that there are already commitments counting both sides, both races. There are four candidates total. But in this brief runoff election, which takes place, it's less than 2 months from now, that election is going to end up costing a total of at least $231 million just for TV ads. Now, all of that is nothing compared to, of course, what's going to happen with the Republican race in 2024. And I thought this was fascinating because that race is going to be, obviously, it's an open seat because you don't just automatically inherit the Republican nomination because you won at a time before. But President Trump is way ahead. The numbers on this are fascinating to me. The story is from Politico, and they actually took a survey where it found that 53% of Republicans say they would like to see President Trump re-nominated for another try in 2024. He beats other notable Republicans, including Vice President Mike Pence. Mike Pence finishes second. Trump gets 53% of support among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents for a hypothetical 2024 Republican primary. Pence came in second at only 12%. Donald Trump Jr. is third with 8%. I don't believe that Donald Trump Jr. is going to make the race, even if his father doesn't. There are people in the Trump orbit who are urging the president to make it clear that he will make the race, which takes the sting, at least according to that theory, out of his loss. The problem here, it seems to me, is that there are going to be key issues, like finishing the job and dealing with the coronavirus, getting those vaccines out to the public. And if the Republicans do succeed in maintaining control of the United States Senate in those crucial Georgia primaries, the idea of establishing a track record, it seems to me, is crucial. But all of that, if President Trump is going to be actively campaigning for 2024, one can only hope that he holds off just a bit before beginning that campaign. Because one of the problems for Republicans everywhere, and you hear this when you talk to Republican managers, is that basically the entire thing becomes yes or no on Trump. And in fact, I think one of the things that was striking about the exit polls in this last election is people were asked a question, do you think that Trump has the temperament to do an effective job as president? Do you think that Biden has the temperament to do an effective job as president? With Biden, 44% of people said no. He doesn't have the temperament, the capabilities to be an effective president of the United States. With Trump, 54% of people said no. And that's almost exactly the number of people when you combine the votes for Joe Biden, who got 51%, plus the votes for various third and fourth and fifth party candidates. President Trump got 47.2% of the vote. So just about the same number of people who thought that they didn't like his temperament. That was the number of people who ended up voting against him. And the idea that it makes sense for him to leave office now, and he will be leaving office, in a burst of good feeling and maybe some appreciation of what President Trump has accomplished in a positive way, that was visible on Fox News with Chris Wallace, who is not President Trump's favorite broadcaster. On Fox News Sunday, Chris Wallace asked a question, important question, of a former Democratic congresswoman, former Senate candidate from California, Southern California, named Jane Harman, whether President Trump deserves some credit for the accomplishments of Operation Warp Speed. This is clip 7, Jeremy.
Doesn't President Trump deserve credit, in fact, a great deal of credit, for Operation Warp Speed and this private partner, public partnership, which has resulted in two vaccines in less than 10 months with more on the way?
Yes, I think he does.
Okay, that's a fairly direct answer. And coming from a liberal Democrat, she portrays herself as a moderate Democrat, Jane Harman. But coming from a Democrat from California, I think that's telling. And I think it's appropriate. And again, if you look at the genial and cheerful President Trump today with the pardoning of the turkeys, and the further that Rudy Giuliani and Jenna Ellis, and particularly, of course, Sidney Powell, the further that they can fall into the background, and we can focus on actual positive agendas that the Republicans in the U.S. Senate, led by Mitch McConnell, can put forward, that's going to work for the Republican Party and for the country. What won't work? Railing against our institutions by the left. Who says so? A liberal-leaning professor at Johns Hopkins University, Stephen Tellis. He joins us coming up on the MedVed Show. One of the things that I think a lot of moderates and conservatives had feared was that if there is an overall Democratic takeover of the federal government, there will be attempts to totally remake our institutions, to get rid of the Electoral College. That would require a constitutional amendment, of course, to give statehood to Puerto Rico and to Washington, D.C., basically pack the court with new Supreme Court appointments and positions for new justices, associate justices on the Supreme Court. There's a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University who's also a senior fellow at the Niskanen Center. And he is Stephen Tellis, and he wrote a powerful piece in the New York Times, which I think is very persuasive, frankly, that suggests that, okay, none of these changes are likely to happen. and people on the left have to adjust to realities. Professor Tellis, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure to have to be here. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, you make, I think, a very strong point at the very beginning. Even if the Democrats manage to win these congressional seats in the senatorial seats in Georgia, which are both up for election right now, they wouldn't really have the ability to make changes of this kind because of one guy named Joe Manchin, who said he won't back an end to the filibuster. He's a Democratic senator from West Virginia. He won't back court packing. Why is that so important?
Well, I think the important thing to note is it's not even just Joe Manchin. In the piece, we mentioned him because he's the most obvious and he's been the most out front about it. But Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona would not be enthusiastic about most of these changes as well, regardless of what their merits are. The most important thing is to say where the legislative filibuster is concerned, the most moderate senators in among the Democrats are the ones who benefit from the filibuster the most, because the filibuster prevents them from having to vote for things that are going to be bad for their electoral well-being. So in general, I think that a lot of Democrats were getting over their skis and thinking that they were ever going to get the kind of majority they needed in order to get rid of the filibuster, because they would have to get pretty much everyone in their caucus to vote for it. And it turns out that the filibuster actually works for a number of the most moderate members.
What about the Electoral College? It's always seemed to me to be extremely unlikely that they would win the three-quarters approval from state legislatures across the country, because there are too many small states that have an interest in the Electoral College. What do people on the left need to acknowledge in changing their attitudes about the existence of the Electoral College?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of differences about the merits if we were all starting from scratch about whether or not we would elect people through an Electoral College. The one thing to say in its favor for the Electoral College is that it, to some degree, decentralizes the process of electoral administration. And I always tell my left-to-center friends that if you think this election was bad, imagine if we had national election administration and Donald Trump was actually in charge of the vote counting process. The Electoral College prevents that by basically putting election administration in the hands of state officials who, as we've seen in Georgia, often even have differences of opinion from their own party leaders.
Okay, you also say in your piece in the New York Times that we need to recognize, you're addressing this to Democrats now, that the cultural values and rituals of Democrats in cosmopolitan cities and liberal institutional bastions like universities don't travel well. Slogans like defund the police and abolish ICE may be mobilizing in places where three-quarters of voters pull the lever for Democrats, but it's madness to imagine that could be the platform of a competitive party nationwide. Why not?
Well, I mean, the most important thing to say about our nation, and I think this is a lesson for both conservatives and liberals, is that it's a very diverse nation, right? We're not Sweden. We're not Switzerland. We're not as basically, you know, although Switzerland's not a homogenous country either, for that matter. But we can't be governed like a consolidated country. And I also have a piece that was out in Politico this last week where I said that a lot of the politics of the last, you know, in some sense, 20 years have been characterized by the fact that there are a number of people who have serious doubts about whether they want to live with the rest of us. Right. I think that's true of both conservatives and liberals. A lot of our culture war politics has been about people who want somehow for us to be a different kind of country, a more homogenous kind of country. Right. But we do have cities that have a very cosmopolitan, generally secular culture, and we have more rural and exurban areas that have a much more religious culture, and there's no way of wishing that away. So we have to find ways to govern the actual country we have with the actual constitution that we have, and not imagine that somehow we could simply abolish the culture of these other parts of the country that that in some cases drive us nuts. And that's where the slogans of things like defund the police and abolish ICE, and certainly there are totally equivalent ones on the right, although my piece is really written for my friends, my liberal to the left friends, that we need to start thinking about not only how to govern the country, but how to have a Democratic Party that incorporates the extraordinary level of diversity that we need both to be elected and to govern a country that looks like that.
And when you're talking about diversity, you're talking about ideological diversity, not just racial, cultural, gender identification diversity, right?
I mean, all of it. Right. I mean, that's the fact, right? That is, if you're going to try and run in North Dakota or you're going to try and run in Nebraska, you're going to be a different kind of Democrat. Right. And now, again, Republicans have a similar problem. Right. They've gotten themselves into a cultural cul-de-sac where it's very hard for them to win in California and New York and places like that. And one of the things I think that the Republican Party is going to be facing in the next few years is trying to figure out how they actually become competitive in a much wider range of states. And that's going to mean themselves having to be a somewhat less homogenous party on all these dimensions. That's, you know, racial, certainly, religious, probably even to a less degree, right? Because there are lots of African-American Christians that they could be appealing to, and Hispanic Christians of both Catholics and evangelicals. But on all those dimensions, both parties imagining that they could govern through the sort of norms of their most intense ideological supporters is really a kind of, is a category mistake.
Assume for just a moment, and we just have a few moments left, but let's assume that Joe Biden is a one-term president because of his age, not because of some kind of disaster. And then who would be the strongest Democrat that comes to mind to you as a presidential candidate? And who do you think would be the strongest Republican to put up in 2024?
Oh, Lord. I certainly think on the Republican side, which actually I spend my professional life mainly studying Republicans and conservatives. Marco Rubio has certainly been trying to figure out a way to thread the needle between the more populist side of the Republican Party and the recognition that the party needs to have a broader range of racial and geographic support. So he's a obvious one. I mean, the problem with somebody like Josh Hawley or Tom Cotton is it's a little harder to imagine them bridging those divisions. On the
Democratic side? And on the Democratic side?
On the Democratic side, I think it's going to be hard to imagine. I think that we actually may be something more like the situation that that we had back in 2008, where the person who wins wasn't actually on our radar a year or two before. So I actually think somebody's going
to
come out.
We will get to that and more. The column by Stephen Tellis of Johns Hopkins University is up at our website at michaelmedved.com. Link there. We'll be right back. One of the things about the whole process of transition and inauguration is it makes people conscious that they're living through history. Presidential inaugurations are memorable, and let's hope that the history of our time proves memorable in a good way, especially once we move beyond this plague-infested year of 2020. And to take a look at other history of the United States, and particularly the most inspiring and encouraging and noble aspects of our history, check out our special holiday sale, which has just begun this week at the MedVed History Store. You can get the whole MedVed History Store library. That's more than 50 different programs on various subjects in the history of this great country, over 100 hours of fascinating stories, and this as presented on our show, but of course without commercial interruption, and it's all 60% off now. It comes to you on a handy thumb drive. You can download it. You can also get it in compact disc editions. go to the Medved History Store Library. Just go to michaelmedved.com, and you can click on the information about the sale. It's 25% off any title. If you just want one title or another title, take a look at what we have on offer. And the lowest prices ever right now, particularly on that History Store Library. Check it out at michaelmedved.com. Concerning the history and the transition, I think it's interesting that, for the most part, the response to President Biden's, President-elect Biden's choices for his key foreign policy posts have been ho-hum, okay, nothing tremendously alarming, nothing tremendously bizarre. These are people who have been around Biden for a long time. They're people with very impressive backgrounds. They're people who have proven themselves in different arenas. Janet Yellen, the appointee for Secretary of the Treasury, is certainly an appointment and an appointee that Wall Street likes and is reassuring in terms of the president's priorities in trying to move forward with an economic recovery from COVID, which is sparking along today, especially with the market up over 30,000. It could make history if it closes at over 30,000 a day. Right at the moment, it's at 30,044. There's one appointment, however, that stands out as a complete dud and a head scratcher, and you have to wonder why. And the New York Post has an editorial board contribution that I'm afraid I kind of agree with. It says Biden climate envoy John Kerry is a lifelong joke.
I've fought in a war. You know that, and other Americans know that.
Okay, in the editorial, they write, at the New York Post, what was Joe Biden thinking for his choice of climate change ambassador extraordinaire? John Kerry is one of the biggest gas bags in American politics, single-handedly responsible for massive amounts of terrible emissions. We look forward to the anti-carbon lectures from a guy who travels the globe on private jets and luxury yachts. And then they write, set aside his deer-in-the-headlights loss as the Democrats' presidential nominee in 2004. He was a joke as Secretary of State under President Barack Obama, off on his yacht during Egypt's 2013 military coup. And he helped craft the 2015 Paris Climate Accord, a performative, non-binding, and they put in quotes, triumph. The only conclusion you can draw is that Biden, having vowed to make fighting climate change a top priority, simply wants someone who'll look like he's trying hard, but won't actually get anything done.
Excuse me.
And if he wants somebody who won't get anything done, I think he's picked the right guy. The Wall Street Journal, by the way, which is generally fairly respectful of Biden's other choices, Wall Street Journal writes, the big disappointment is John Kerry as a cabinet-level envoy for climate. As a negotiator, Mr. Kerry never drives a hard bargain, as his Iran nuclear deal showed. His cabinet status suggests that climate will be a special negotiating priority rather than one issue among many in foreign policy. Why can't Mr. Blinken handle it? Mr. Blinken, Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State designate. Perhaps this is meant to be diplomatic theater to appease the climate left. I think that's correct.
I have a plan.
But it is a bad signal if Mr. Biden considers climate to be a leading national security issue. The fracking-led boom in U.S. oil and gas production has enhanced American security in multiple ways. I think they're right. And I also do think it's worth listening at least to some of the, you could say, more what they call in the Wall Street Journal liberal internationalism that you hear from some of the president-elect's new appointees. Antony Blinken spoke this morning when President-elect Biden presented this group, and he actually spoke fairly movingly about his stepfather, who as a child, was a Holocaust survivor. This is clip 20, the Secretary of State nominee, Antony Blinken. Listen.
And my late stepfather, Samuel Pizarro, he was one of 900 children in his school in Bialystok, Poland, but the only one to survive the Holocaust after 4 years in concentration camps. At the end of the war, he made a break from a death march into the woods in Bavaria. From his hiding place, he heard a deep rumbling sound. It was a tank, but instead of the Iron Cross, he saw painted on its side a five-pointed white star. He ran to the tank. The hatch opened. An African-American GI looked down at him. He got down on his knees and said the only three words that he knew in English that his mother taught him before the war. God bless America. That's who we are. That's what America represents to the world, however imperfectly. Now, we have to proceed with equal measures of humility and confidence. Humility because, as the president-elect said, we can't solve all of the world's problems alone. We need to be working with other countries. We need their cooperation.
And that was Secretary of State designate Antony Blinken, who will be facing confirmation by the U.S. Senate, along with President-elect Biden's other nominees for cabinet office. Coming up, we will be talking a little bit about one of the ideas that is being pushed very heavily by the left, and it's a lunatic idea. The idea that Biden should begin his administration by wrecking his entire presidency. How would he do it? By trying through executive order or even legislative persuasion to forgive all college loans. Just wipe them out. $1.6 trillion worth of forgiving college loans. We'll speak with a distinguished conservative college professor about that, Paul Kengor of Grove City College. Coming up, there's also a, speaking of the survival of Samuel Pizarro, who was the stepfather for the new Secretary of State, we will be talking a little bit about a fury that has emerged, and it really is worldwide, about a Holocaust museum that is now hosting a special exhibit on George Floyd. Really? George Floyd, a tragedy and a very sad story, but should it be classified together with the Holocaust and the organized, deliberate murder of some 6 million people? And speaking of murder, terrible statistics from Seattle about the tremendous upsurge in the homicide rate this year. And how does the city council respond? They respond by cutting the police budget by 20%. Now, there are people on the left, Jesus, who are angry about this. They say, wait, you promised to cut the police budget by 50%. What kind of lunatic, honestly, what kind of America-hating lunatic believes that you will get greater public safety, which we all crave, and in every community, particularly communities of color, by simply slashing the money we spend on public safety? We will get to that and much more. A tweet of the day by Ilhan Omar. And yes, it's nutty. That and more in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.